morning. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate weeks with Dr. Hal Schertz, and you are lucky enough to get me this week. So thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. We promote freedom of choice in healthcare by the empowerment of physicians and the empowerment of patients so that doctor and patient can support their doctor-patient relationship and make good healthcare decisions together. So thank you very much for listening this morning. Well, David's here at the board with me today as usual. I'm hungover today, David. I have got the big, nasty hangover, and it's not because I had too much to drink last night, or although Lord knows I could have. Today is April 16th. It is the morning after the night before. Tax returns or your extension were due into the government postmarked about 8 hours ago. And every time I do this paperwork and get the stuff from my accountant that I have to pay a huge, ridiculous amount of money for just to be compliant. We are reminded that the top 10% of earners in the country, which, by the way, is $125,000 a year or more. So, you know, if you think that it's the evil top 1% or the evil top 10%, let me remind you that if you bring home $10,000 a month or more before taxes, you are what the liberals consider to be one of those evil rich people that needs to pay more and needs to pay their quote-unquote fair share. We also remember today that last month, in March, the government spent $58 billion more than it took in. And the government is not spending your money and my money well. And there are some other very interesting statistics, and it's a little beyond the scope of the show. We'll hit them quickly, but we spent $168 billion as a nation last year just to be compliant with 80,000 pages of federal tax code. We spent about 7 billion hours as a country getting that stuff together. And if you do a little bit of primitive math, if you assume that health insurance for a family costs, say, $1,000 a month, with that $168 billion that we go in tax returns or spend preparing our tax returns, we could provide health insurance in the private market, right? Go to Blue Cross Blue Shield for 15 million families. That pretty much covers the uninsured. Now, I'm not saying that math is perfect, but suffice it to say that if we had a tax system that was not so costly just to follow the letter of the law, that it would free up enough money to significantly solve our health care problems with the uninsured and all of these things that we get preached to about without Obamacare, without healthcare.gov, and without all of that ridiculous overhead. I'm also a little hungover today because of the recent passage through the Senate of the Doc Fix, the SGR Medicare Doc Fix, which we are going to talk about today a little bit more. But there is some good news. The good news for you, the listener, today is that you do not have to listen to my voice droning all morning by myself. I am lucky enough, I am privileged enough to have a guest this morning. She is Twyla Braes. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Twyla Braes, RN. She is the president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. She is a certified public health nurse, and she is much better at this radio thing than I am. She is on the air every day for a minute doing the Health Freedom Minute. She routinely testifies before state legislatures, goes on Fox News, NBC Today Show, CNN, all the neat stuff that maybe I'll be able to do someday. But we are pleased and privileged to have Twyla this morning. Good morning, Twyla. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
You know what? I can't hear her, David. Can you pop me up a little bit? Oh, do it here. Okay. I'm going to push them all up. Okay. That's good. Thank you, Twyla, for being on the show with us this morning.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So we're going to talk first, I think. I just want to give you some time to talk about the Citizens Council for Health Freedom and sort of give the listeners an outline of what you're all about.
Sure. Citizens Council for Health Freedom has been around. This is our 21st year, and we are a nonprofit organization doing both state and national work. We're located in Minnesota, but we're doing both state and national work around the country. Our mission is essentially to protect healthcare choices, individualized patient care, and medical and genetic privacy for individuals. And one of our little slogans is that we want health freedom for all, as opposed to health care for all or health insurance for all, which is what the other side is looking for. We want health freedom for all. And so some of the issues that we're known for is what we do on privacy. And the reason why privacy is important, because I think a lot of people think privacy is all just about keeping your information private, but we look at privacy as he who holds the data makes the rules. In other words, privacy is all about control. And so if you want to control what's happening in your personal relationship or your professional relationship with your physician, you really need to be the one who has control of the data. If the government gets access to the data through all of these things that they're doing now to try and get that access, then the government can monitor you, the patient, and track your physician, and make decisions about how much the physician gets paid according to his or her compliance with quality measures. And that takes the control out of the patient's and the doctor's hands. So that's why we have looked at privacy for a very long time as not being so much about privacy, although there are things that people are consider very private in their medical records. But at the end of the day, it's really about who will have control of medical decisions.
Okay. I find that very interesting and very intriguing, Twyla, and I'll tell you why. Because in my mind, it's always been the privacy in healthcare information or medical records really was focused on demographic information, that information which would allow unscrupulous folks to commit identity theft. But what you're telling us, and I think you're right, is that it really goes far beyond that.
Oh, yes. Far beyond that. And you're right about identity theft and actually medical ID theft, which is the medical ID is a number in your medical records that thieves consider far more valuable even than your Social Security number, because there's so much money that they can get if they get your medical ID. They can get it either in healthcare services or just because of the big programs like Medicare and Obamacare and Medicaid. They can commit fraud using the medical ID number. So there is that piece of it, and it's very expensive and difficult for a patient to try to correct their medical records once that has happened. But on the other end of it, which I'm talking about, is really this is how the government and the health plans plan to seize control of the entire medical delivery process is through the data and through the tracking and through the payment reform, which is really about bonuses and demerits, as it were, bonuses and penalties, according to how compliant you are with how they want you to practice medicine. And so, yes, I think a lot of people, when they think privacy, I know they do. They say to me, I don't have anything in my medical record that I consider private. And one thing I will tell them is, have you looked? Because I have found that doctors have made statements about patients that patients would disagree with that are in their medical records. And I've had them call our office and say, I don't want to give Dr. B my medical records now that I know what Dr. A said. And so, you know, there can be private things that you don't even know in your medical records that you don't want shared because it's just someone's opinion. And but in addition to that, I just tried to tell them it's really not as much about your privacy as about your control and about how they will use your data to conduct studies, to push certain policies, to eliminate access to certain treatments, very much like is going to happen under Obamacare with PCORI, which is the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which got more than $1 billion to do comparative effectiveness research. Essentially to compare one treatment versus another and say, this is what works. Now, it may work for 75% or 85% of the population, and they may or may not be right about their so-called research. But what about the 15% of the population who won't get it because it's not considered effective? So this is where the control comes through the data.
So it's all very innocent sounding, right? I mean, you know, these institutions have very sort of benign sounding names. I mean, you know, comparative effectiveness sounds a bit vague, but doesn't sound, you know, very intrinsically harmful. But the concept you got to understand is that, you know, the folks behind big government are very good at using language to disguise the true intent of the measures that they propose to take. And you have to really get, you know, beneath the cover of the book and read the fine print, some 2,000 plus pages in the case of Obamacare, to really get an understanding of the bad intentions, the evil intentions that lie beneath.
Right. And so, like you said, they're really good with words. So one of the words is evidence-based medicine. And evidence-based medicine sounds really good. However, we did a report quite a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, on evidence-based medicine and the folly of it, and how even peer-reviewed researchers say, you know, point out all the problems in this so-called evidence-based medicine. But evidence-based medicine is intended to say we, the government, or we, the health plans, have evidence-based medicine requirements, and you have to follow evidence-based medicine. And that's whatever the health plans and the government say that it is. And yet there are two folks with PhDs who wrote a book called Tarnished Gold and talked about how evidence-based medicine is completely false and how it's actually dangerous to patients to be limited to whatever, you know, to whatever this definition happens to be, and how really evidence-based medicine all came out of the legal side of things, because evidence is what you do when it comes to in court. And science is what you do when it comes to in the clinic. But even then, science is changing all the time according to what you learn next and next and next and next, which changes what you thought you knew before. So, you know, words are really important in swaying the public's opinion, and evidence-based medicine has swayed the public to believe there is such a thing when really that there isn't, but it's all about controlling what happens in the exam room or at the bedside with the patient.
Indeed. Well, believe it or not, Twyla, we are at the end of the first segment, so we're going to take a short break. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Come right back.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you for listening with us this morning. We have as a very special guest, Ms. Twyla Brace, RN, president and co-founder of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. So, Twyla, before we get back to the discussion, a couple of housekeeping notes. The first is that on our website, I was aghast to learn last week that the buttons for donation on the donation page weren't working. So I wanted to get the word out to everyone this morning that that page is now up and running, and that we're asking you once again to go to our webpage, which is www.D4PC, Foundation, D4PCFoundation.org. Click the link in the upper right-hand corner for donations, and I promise you that's all working right now. We need to have funding to maintain the things that we do, maintain this radio show. So thank you very much in advance for contributing. So we were talking about evidence-based research, and not to diminish the validity of the scientific method, but much of what is touted as evidence and much of what is touted as absolute, unquestioned scientific knowledge leads to government guidelines and the physician's resultant loss of ability to make individual decisions for individual patients where all of the statistics just might not be appropriate.
Right, and I think, what patients may not understand, but doctors do, is that now that the move to electronic health records has happened in a major way because of a 2009 law, whatever is on the computer is what the physician can do. So if what the physician decides they want to do is not on the computer, it becomes much more difficult. I remember talking with a physician several years ago who had moved from his own independent practice into a larger healthcare system. And I said to him, so how is your autonomy? And he said, what autonomy? If it's not on the computer, I can't do it. And this is sort of like, in-the-box medical care. And what patients really want is a physician who can look outside the box. Yes, there's, whatever the traditional care might be, they want to have that kind of care. But what if they're unusual? What if their situation is unusual? What if there's a new treatment that they know about or the doctor knows about? What if there's a medication that the doctor knows will work for this situation that isn't necessarily the usual medication for that situation, but because of how it works, it would work for this patient? It might not be there for them to click. And that is very limiting on the excellence of healthcare, because healthcare needs to be flexible and adaptable to the patient. And the doctor needs to be able to do whatever is necessary for the patient. But if you're limited to whatever the protocols are on the computer screen, and if it's very difficult for you to go beyond those protocols, or you have to ask for permission, or you have to explain why you do something else, or it's not even there to order on the screen.
Absolutely.
Then it becomes very difficult to give the patient what they need.
Well, I am so glad you brought that up. You're the first person besides myself that I have ever heard give voice to that concept, because I have brought that up to some of my colleagues in the health information technology community, and I have said, hey, look, if I exceed my monthly quota, let's say, of an expensive drug, a PPI for acid reflux. I see lots of patients with acid reflux because I'll get a lot of voice and throat complaints. But I have always been concerned that if I exceed my quota for an expensive drug, that the computer is tracking me, and one day on the 20th or 25th of the month, that button to click to fill that prescription simply disappears, because the computer is watching my every move, and folks behind the scenes who have back-end connectivity to my electronic medical record system go, oh, hey, Dr. Karuchak here has exceeded his, monthly quota of expensive drug A. We're just going to shut him down. And that button disappears from the screen. And, the folks in the health IT community that I have talked about have kind of poo-pooed that and said, oh, well, that's never going to happen. And I'm like, seriously? I mean, clearly the technology exists to make that happen. So what stops them from imposing, as you're talking about spot on, these, so-called evidence-based protocols and quality measures and cost containment measures, sort of like IPAB in a computer, will force me to do certain things that I don't consider to be medically appropriate. I mean, I had a patient yesterday, exactly what you're talking about, Twyla, somebody who came in with something called vocal tremor, which is that tremulous voice that, older folks often get. But to my ear, it sounded different than the average vocal tremor. It wasn't something I could quantify or something that I could, put on paper in any sort of objective way, except to say that to my ear, this sounds different. And as a result, my treatment for her was far different than your quote-unquote average patient with vocal tremor, and if I were constrained by some sort of guidelines that were put in a computer, I couldn't have done the right thing for her.
Right.
So,
and she doesn't know, and that, you know, that's the interesting thing about all this, is that patients think that certain things about the payment of healthcare have changed, but they don't understand how the delivery of healthcare has changed and is continuing to change and will be increasingly squeezed in the ability of the doctor to take care of them. There are just assumptions about healthcare that, you know, we've always been able to get access to anything, and isn't it great that we live in America because we have all this, and they don't understand what's happening behind the scenes or behind a computer or in policy circles, or how what happens in Congress or at the state legislatures impacting what their doctors can and cannot do because of the payment system and because they have handed over the payment for health care to outsiders, to people who have different value judgments about them and about health care in general and about how much they're willing to pay for somebody's health care. Because now, for the most part, the patient... yes, the patient, now as the deductibles have gone up, the patients are paying more. But for the, you know, the really expensive things, they, you know, it's all about what will the health plan pay, or what will the government pay, or what will the health plan, who is the contractor for the government, pay.
No, absolutely. So in that context, what do you think of this recent bill, the so-called Doc Fix, the bill that, you know, page 1, 2, and 3 repealed the SGR formula for physician payment, but there's another 200 pages behind that that do some very different things. So what's your take on that?
Well, you know, isn't that always kind of the way it is? There's some headliner title for a bill, and then until you actually look, you don't realize that it's way more than the repeal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were opposed. As you know, it has passed, and I don't think the president has signed it yet, but it's on its way.
Yes.
It has passed, and it will become law, and the SGR system will be done. But our concern with it was that we really look at this as a pro-Obamacare bill, and this really didn't get any discussion in the news. But the creation of the two different payment systems, this merit-based incentive payment system, as well as the alternative payment system, both of those are very much into the payment reforms that Obamacare set into play. And if you needed more evidence as to that fact, one of the White House economic advisors to the president said to the American Center for Progress, which is the group that helped to write Obamacare, he was giving a speech to them, and he was saying how great this bill was because it really expanded on the payment reforms in Obamacare. And so this alternative system where the doctors join together into a group and they get a lump sum payment for this group of patients for the year. Well, this is very much like the accountable care organizations in Obamacare, where the accountable care organization gets a lump sum for a group of patients over a year. And what this really does is it forces the doctors to ration the care themselves. It takes the rationing out of the health plans. It takes the rationing out of the government. And now we have the doctors in conflict of interest with their patients because the doctors are at risk for the financial cost of the patient. They get a lump sum. If in November or October of the year they don't have very much left, what are the patients going to be doing who come in for those last 3 months? Or how will the health care be divvied out over the year in hopes of having some left at the end? And the interesting thing about this is if there is money left over at the end of the year, the doctors get to have that money, but only if they meet certain quality metrics set up by the government. So, you know, they're being pulled at two ends and all in conflict with the patient. The merit-based pay one has the government judging doctors from giving them scores from 0 to 100, with 0 being the best possible and 100 being the worst possible. And if doctors choose not to report on these varying qualities that the government once reported, then the doctors are assumed to be the very worst, and they will get the penalty. The penalty starts at 4% in 2019 and goes up to 9% of your Medicare payment by 2022 and stays at that level going forward. Now, I'm trying to think who that was, but some government agency, a county agency, whose name I just can't remember at the moment, looked at this whole system before the bill was passed and said it's actually going to be worse than the SGR system if you'd had the 21% cut. Because at the end of the day, as you go out into the out years, there's going to be even less money for doctors than that cut of 21%, meaning that Congress is again going to be trying to look for doc fixes in the future in order to have enough money, especially as, you know, all the baby boomers are now coming in. And so the number of people on Medicare is just expanding while the amount of money is decreasing. And this is one of the reasons where our organization has said, or I have said, written in a paper about 10 years ago, that Medicare needs an escape plan, not a rescue plan. We need to have the ability of people to get out of Medicare and to have long-term private insurance to the end of their days. There's no reason that we have paid all our insurance bills up to age 65 and then we get dropped. And all the money that we put in there we can no longer access, and now we're on the dole. And dependent on whatever the political winds of Congress say that we can have or can't have, or what kind of doctors are available or aren't, or how much money is available or isn't. And then the fact that, you know, with Medicare, I think a lot of people don't know this, but with Medicare, if a doctor orders something, but Medicare says no, and the patient says to the doctor, well, I'll just pay, the doctor has to tell that patient you can't pay, because that
absolutely
would be considered fraud.
That's right. And that is, I'm glad you brought that up. You're bringing up some great stuff today, Twyla. We'll pick this up in the next segment. Believe it or not, we're at the end of segment two. We'll pick up the discussion on Medicare in a couple of minutes. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us. That's an order.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thanks very much for spending time with us this morning. We have still by phone our very special guest, Ms. Twyla Braes, RN, co-founder of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Let me remind you, you've heard a bunch of, in the break there, again, some pitches for that we very much need your financial support. And I do want to emphasize that we are a 501c3 organization, and in contrast to where we have been in the more distant past, now these donations are tax deductible the way any other contribution would be regarded. So Twyla and I were discussing Medicare. We were discussing some of the myths surrounding Medicare and the idea that if Medicare doesn't cover a service, the doctor and the patient have essentially no options, true?
That's correct, unless they can find a doctor who has opted out of Medicare and done the affidavit for 2 years, although now with the DocFix, they won't have to re-up that. That might be one of the only good things about the DocFix bill. Very small, but anyway, so that is true, and they may or may not be able to find the specialist that they need or the person who really understands them who will be willing to accept cash for the care that they need. Now, I just want to let your listeners know that on our website, www.cchfreedom.org, cchfreedom.org, my paper on Medicare needing an escape plan rather than a rescue plan can be found on the homepage, as well as your listeners can sign up for our e-news, which comes out every Wednesday, and it has a commentary from me, plus some other interesting news that I think a lot of people don't talk about. And that's at the very top of our homepage at cchfreedom.org.
Okay, I'm going to repeat that one more time because my audio quality is better on this end. So that's www.cch, C as in cat, C as in cat, H, freedom.org, and that's where you can find that.
That's correct. Thank you.
Okay, absolutely. Okay, proceed.
So one of the other things with Medicare that people don't know is if you choose, because now you've heard about the trouble with Medicare, and if you're on Medicare, you can't pay cash for care that's denied. And so there are people who have enough money who say, well, then I'm just going to get off of Medicare, and I still have my plan from, you know, whatever company that I used to be employed by, or and so I'm just going to get off of Medicare. Well, if you get off of Medicare, you lose your Social Security payments. So all of those monies that went to the government for all those years that you worked now become the government's, and you can't have access to them. Now, a lot of people can't do that, and they don't want to do that. They don't want to lose all those years of payments, and so they can't get off of Medicare. This particular prohibition on leaving Medicare and losing your Social Security benefits, that's not a law. It's not a rule. It's something that the administration made up years ago, and they put it in a booklet. And there was a lawsuit against the government, but in January of 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear the lawsuit. And to me, that's just phenomenal.
That
it's not
is.
A law. It's not a rule. It was just made up by the government, and the Supreme Court decided not to hear it. But this is, you know, these are some of the things that people don't understand about Medicare and how, you know, it's going to ration care more and more and more. As more people come in and fewer dollars come in, and it's unsustainable. It's a $43 trillion unfunded liability, which is more than twice the national debt. And that's why we really have to give people... we have to change the law so that people can actually get out of Medicare, keep their private coverage, and, you know, maybe have Medicare just for the poor, or to have other systems for the poor, or just leave it for the states, really. You know, the whole problem in healthcare is that we got Medicare in the first place. So, you know, there has to be rethinking of this, and the public just doesn't really understand what kind of dilemma that they are in and that their doctors will be put in as a result of Medicare and how it got the government into health care?
Well, you have the same recurring themes all over again, whether you're looking at Medicare or you're looking at all the scandals surrounding the VA, or as we talked about last week, you know, here in Atlanta, we've got some local news that's gotten some national attention with Atlanta Public Schools and teachers falsifying students' test scores to keep their bonuses coming and to keep their job security. Anytime that you eliminate competition from the marketplace, which I think is what you're talking about when you say give patients an escape from Medicare rather than a rescue from Medicare, give them other options, that you take away the ultimate truly effective pay-for-performance program or quality assurance program, which is to give the recipients of the service a choice on where to go.
Right. Now, of course, people who love Medicare will say, but we are, because we have given them the Medicare Advantage option as opposed to the traditional option. But it's still all government. And that Medicare Advantage is just health plans who are making off like bandits, getting more money as a result of the government wanting to move the entire system over into the health plans. That there still is really no choice. It's sort of like it's the same back end with just different front ends, but it's all working the same at the back end.
Exactly. And, you know, there was an interesting blog post from one Dr. Joseph Kelly, who wrote a blog post in the American College of Surgeons blog. He is the director of business operations for a 36-surgeon private practice in, I think it's Chattanooga. So this is somebody who's not only a physician, but obviously an accomplished administrator and, you know, says, and quite justifiably, I think, an intimate understanding of all aspects of healthcare financing, policy, legislation, and regulation. And he is basically saying that with these all these new quality assurance programs that are part of, you know, the back end of the SGR doc fix bill, that it will be impossible for a private practice surgeon to maintain financial sovereignty or solvency, goes on to say what I have said in my own household personally for years, which is that I'm not encouraging my high school age kids to pursue a career in medicine. They're much better off being, you know, mid-levels, because clearly a nurse practitioner like my wife is, or a physician assistant, is a far better return on investment, because you can be free of all of those burdens. But it was a very powerful post. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically the idea that this bill is really the beginning of the end for the kind of personalized quality care that, you know, America has always kind of led the way.
Yes, right. And, of course, I think that the, well, I guess we'll see, won't we? When the physicians who decide to go out on their own and disconnect themselves from Medicare and all these restraints, the degree to which the federal government or states will crack down on them, either through licensure or audits or whatever. Because what really has to happen is that the physicians do disconnect themselves from Medicare. It's one of the ways that patients around the country will start to understand what kind of situation they are truly in as a patient. And that's the way that the pressure will actually be put on Congress to let them out. And so I think, you know, we have painful times coming. Patients have really the power, more than the physicians do, to change things. But the only way that that will work is if they get alerted to what's happening. And for a very, very, very long time, everything that's happened, the doctors have just taken it and hid it from the patients. But I think it's really time to let the patients know exactly what kind of trouble that they're in. And really, the doctors have the ability to do that. But we'll see, I guess, to what extent that happens.
Well, for years, I mean, going all the way back to the, you know, the days of the advent of managed care 25 or 30 years ago, you know, what I call the competitive stakeholders in healthcare, the health plans, the hospitals, the politicians, government, et cetera, have exploited a personality trait that is common to almost all physicians, which is that we are pleasers. You know, we made it through school and we made it through training and we got, you know, our medical education, both, you know, formal school and postgraduate, by pleasing the people around us, by not being confrontational, by not pointing out that the emperor is not wearing any clothes. And so you're exactly right, Twyla, right? When managed care came along, we took it. We just took the decreased reimbursements and said, we'll work harder. We'll work longer. We'll go from, you know, 45-hour weeks to 50 to 60 to 70-hour weeks. But at some point, we have to pass that on because we simply can't we've lost the ability to absorb any farther.
Right. And yesterday, in my commentary in the e-news, I wrote about the new medical education, training the doctor, the new doctors for the system. And it came from an article, now it just escapes me, but you can find it on our website, cchfreedom.org. But I just forget what the main article was. Oh, no, the National Public Radio was talking about this new medical education. And really, if you're a doctor or an astute patient and you read what the comments were, it should be kind of scary. Because they're basic. One of the things that they said was we're now focusing on teaching about the entire healthcare system and how it works, rather than just how to treat patients.
Well, yeah, and I've heard that from other sources that now physicians are being taught that they are merely members of a team, and I don't have any problem with the team approach, obviously. We work with nurses, of course, and physical therapists and whatnot. But the doctor has been charged historically with the task of being the leader of that team and in the end taking final responsibility for the outcome of care. But now, you know, and as you are very correctly pointing out, you know, the emphasis has shifted. The emphasis has shifted from the doctor being the leader of that team to just being another drone. Just being another worker bee, and it gets back into the whole, you know, technology thing, and I it's interesting. I found an article last night looking, and again, this also came from NPR, talking about millennial doctors may be more tech savvy, but is that better? And it actually draws parallels with the old movie that Tom Cruise was in, Top Gun, from many, many years ago, saying that. You know, why was the Top Gun school formed? Because in Vietnam, you know, fighter pilots were losing their dogfighting skills because they were over-relying on technology. And as a result, their effectiveness as fighter pilots was decreasing. So we said, okay, we're going to make this Top Gun school and, you know, rebuild their dogfighting skills. So anyhow, I'll finish that thought at the fourth segment. We're at the break. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, host of Detailing Addiction and medical director of the Atlanta Healing Center. Please join me on Tuesday afternoons at 4 p.m.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today.
Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host here for the final segment. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for sticking with us. We'll make this last segment worth it as well. So thank you for sticking with us. We have as our guest today Ms. Twyla Braes from the Citizens Council for Healthcare Freedom. We were talking about the effect of technology on medical training and how perhaps, according to some stuff put out by NPR, that maybe, you know, the over-reliance on technology plus sort of a subtle shift in the emphasis of training in medical students and residents may be producing doctors that are more like worker bees than thought leaders the way they should be, you think?
I do think that, because critical thinking skills do not come from following somebody else's, limited thoughts of how something has to be done. So if these doctors are all trained that they have to put everything into the computer and they have to click on the computer and everything is about the computer, their brain becomes as limited by the four sides of the computer. And what a patient really wants, especially if they're out of the ordinary, is a critically thinking doctor who will be creative and who will think about how the physiology works and how the psychology works and how the emotions works and the situation that person is in, and put that all together and come up with a diagnosis and a treatment plan specific to that person. And so if you are focused on technology and the limits of what you're allowed to click, and, it starts to limit what you're allowed to think. And so I do think that is likely to be a problem. And when you mentioned about teams, that's one thing that was in the NPR thing. You know, we asked one of the medical schools that we have to train doctors how to be teams. And I, too, said in my piece yesterday that doctors have always been part of teams. They've led the team.
Yes.
But there's a story that I got from someone that I included in the e-news yesterday, which is on our website, which is very interesting, about someone who tried to figure out who was actually accountable for who was making the medical decisions of the neighbor that he and his wife were in charge of watching over.
Sure.
It proved impossible. It was all done by the computer.
Yeah, and you have this decentralization and sort of diffusion of responsibility and accountability, and, you know, every single member of that kind of leaderless team is going to, you know, assume, I mean, reasonably from an individual standpoint, that, you know, somebody else is making the decision, or the decisions are going to happen by, you know, some kind of magic, or, you know, that the computer is sort of going to gather everybody's disjointed thoughts and somehow synthesize those into a plan all by itself. But, you know, that kind of decision making, you know, can't happen unless there is one person, which should be the physician, making those decisions and doing that kind of, you know, cognitive assimilation of information and opinions and thoughts and scientific evidence, obviously has a role to play, but not the lead role and not the only role. But yeah, that's going to be a problem in the future. I mean, I had a patient yesterday. I mean, the anecdotal stories are a very effective way to do that. But this was somebody I was asked to see in the hospital. I think I'm one of the last ear, nose, and throat doctors on the planet that actually goes to the hospital to see really sick people. And this was somebody who had fallen and had broken their hip. She's 87 years old. And she had had some swallowing difficulties, and they had gotten what's called a modified barium swallow, where you drink some X-ray dye and they take some pictures. And they had found an anatomic problem that, in theory, is amenable to an operation. And so I was called in to see this patient, you know, charged with the task of doing this operation. This person has a Zenker's diverticulum. They need this operation. Please come in and do this for us. I'm like, okay. So you look over the chart and you look over the entire patient, right, not just their imaging study, and talk to the family and get a real sense of who this lovely lady was. And you assemble the facts together and discover that really the operation's not the right thing for her. and that there were other options that we could use to approach her swallowing problems, which were far safer. And in the end, I thought, well, the surgery, because of her other medical problems, probably had a 50-50 chance that she wouldn't survive. But, there's no protocol that guides that. That's a question of meeting this patient, looking her in the eye, talking to her son, talking to her sister, talking to her daughter. And, I mean, it was a good 30 to 45-minute cognitive process that you are never going to be able to plug into a computer or a server or an EMR and have it spit out your answer. And when it came to the team approach, yes, we used the team. We talked about what to do instead of an operation, but there had to be one person that kind of took the reins and called the attending physician and the hospitalist and the patient's primary care physician and make those decisions and make things happen. But that doesn't happen by a nebulous, accountability-less team approach.
Right. And actually, there is somebody leading the team, even in the leaderless. It's just someone behind the computer in an executive position who probably isn't a doctor and who, made sure that certain protocols, et cetera, were all on the computer. So, but what you want in healthcare is actually to have a real live person, your physician who has the most training, actually leading the team.
Exactly.
A way that you can talk with them.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody with face-to-face accountability,
yes,
and
right,
sort of that direct kind of communication that's really made, at least up until recently, America was, the place to go. We got about 5 minutes left, Twyla. Let's talk about the Nationwide Health Information Network. I think this is something that is in process. But again, it's one of these things that has a very innocent-sounding title. It has something that, you think, well, of course a health information network sounds, it has to be a good thing. But why don't you give us the real story about that?
So the name of this National Medical Record System has changed over time, and now it is actually called the eHealth Exchange, sounding even more nebulous and
yes,
even nicer. But the fact of the matter is it's about allowing any doctor, any government official, anyone under HIPAA, and that's a lot of folks, to have access to your medical records, your entire medical record, no matter where it is, to link it together, to pull it together without your consent. A lot of your listeners may not understand that HIPAA does not protect your privacy. It actually opened up your medical record, allowing it to be put online into electronic systems and shared with countless others. According to the federal government, under HIPAA, more than 2.1 million people can have access, entities can have access to your medical record without your consent if there's a reason. But all of these folks, including 1.5 million business associates, can have access without your consent. And that doesn't include the government. All the government agencies can also have access without your consent. And once you put everything online and make it through an EHR, an electronic health record, and you make that electronic health record hook up to the national system or to the state systems, and then the state systems all hook up with each other, or even if Epic and others get together and decide how to hook up all your records, because of HIPAA, you will no longer have any privacy. You will no longer have any control. You will become a research subject by virtue of the fact that all of these folks are able to do research of various kinds, including policy research or including Obamacare research meant to limit your access to care. And you'll never get a second opinion, a fresh second opinion. And every comment that's ever made about you by any doctor or any person will all be available to all of these people. And so we say that HIPAA needs to be repealed and the rule needs to be rescinded so that now they have to go back to patient consent before they can share your information outside the four walls of whatever institution that you're in. But today, Obama understood that, first of all, he had to have control of the data in order to control what was happening in the exam room. And so the very first thing he did in 2009 was put in HITECH, which mandated electronic health records interoperable across the country. And then a year later, he passed Obamacare. But his secretary has said that the mandate for the electronic health records was a foundational piece of Obamacare. So this is where we'd like everybody in their states to talk to their state legislators and say, we need real privacy laws. And under HIPAA, if a state legislature passes a true privacy law and gives you back your consent, that's the law that has to be followed. And there should be consent before any of your data can leave the four walls of whatever institution that you are in.
Agreed. And again, these folks seem to, and again, I was sort of looking at the government websites about this, that they claim that, you know, sharing all of this de-identified data is somehow going to make healthcare better. But I don't know of any evidence where that's actually occurred.
No, but, and actually there are comments in official federal documents about not even being sure that this is working or that it will work or that it will even save money or save lives. But in addition to that, just so that you know, it's not de-identified data. It's all identifiable. And they really would like a unique patient identifier issued by the federal government in order to hook all of your medical records together, to have a longitudinal, lifelong record of who you are. And, of course, that is not what patients want.
Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong on the details of this, I think HIPAA specifies, I think, seven criteria under which medical records, again, as I think you correctly point out, not de-identified, but full disclosure, I think there's like seven criteria, and I think quality improvement in research is one of those criteria, and I think that's the umbrella under which all of this is happening.
Well, there are all sorts of reasons that it can be shared, including 12 national priority purposes, which give the government all of this access and give outsiders, including law enforcement, access to these medical records without consent, and judges, etc. So I'm not sure about which seven criteria you're talking about, but
maybe it was, you know what, the number may have been 12, but I remember, you know, law enforcement being there, you know, the ability to share records with, you know, a specialist if somebody is going to see another physician, that sort of thing. Well, believe it or not, we are at the end of the hour. We have been privileged to have Ms. Twyla Brace here for this hour to talk about some really neat stuff. Twyla, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.